Today's program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to
Foment About It
on Heritage Radio Network.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette, your hosts. We broadcast live every Monday night at 7 p.m.
And if you get... Oh, where?
Go ahead.
On heritageradionetwork.org.
Yeah, we're actually in Bushwick in the back of Roberta's, a great pizza beer place. And we're a show that's all about fermentation, particularly homebrewing, but we're also exploring other things. So tonight, we have a very special episode. This is part one of two, and we're going to be discussing smelling and tasting beer. We're going to start today with off flavors. We're very lucky to have two special guests in the studio with us.
Absolutely. I'm very excited that they're here. But first, we have a couple of announcements. What's up, Mary? Brooklyn Brew Shop.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, so Brooklyn Brew Shop has a new subscription club. It's called the Quarterly Brew Club. Let me bring it up here. And basically, they're doing some new seasonals that are exclusive. Well, not only their seasonals, but some brew kits that are exclusive to this quarterly brew club. And they subscriptions, they still have some availability. You can get them in 2 or 4 quarters, so basically 6 months in a year. And you get 3 of their newest seasonal brews quarterly, including 1 or 2 that are exclusive to the club, on each given season, and it starts at $90 for 2 quarters, which is 6 months. These are the great little 1 gallon brew kits that Brooklyn Brew Shop does, so I just wanted to make people aware of that because I think it's a neat program.
Especially if you don't have very much room to be brewing. Mm-hmm. In addition, coming up, again, I just want to reiterate that we're coming up on Homebrew Alley 7. This is a national AHA, BAJCP sanctioned homebrew competition. And deadline to register and to get all your entries in is February 1st. That's coming up this Friday. You can find out more information at homebrewalley.org. And this ties into today's topics because we're talking about off flavors in beer, and here with us are national beer judge BR Roylia. Hi, BR.
Hello.
and Vladimir Kowalik,
who's
from the New York
National
City
Home
Brewers Guild. Absolutely, national home brewers. National judge.
Hello.
Vlad has been very awesome and part of the guild. He is basically spearheading our BJCP classes on behalf of the guild, going on 5 years now.
I think we've been going on 8 years,
yep.
On
but
and
for
off,
you,
but
yes.
Consistently the last 5 years, yes.
Absolutely, and it's awesome. How many people come to this?
We had to cap at a max of 30 because at one point we had 45 people in a room not much bigger than this. And while it was a lot of fun, it was not particularly educational at points.
Right.
So, yeah, we have about 25 registered so far this year.
What is the BJCP?
Beer Judge Certification Program, and it is a not-for-profit that, well, we should know this,
oh, wait,
right?
This is question number
this is
one.
Question number one. Recognizes,
how could you forget?
I know. Recognizes beer evaluation and tasting skills.
That's right. That's right. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's basically a way to train homebrew judges. So there's a lot of homebrew competitions, including Homebrew Alley, coming up, and they need a way for people to be able to judge beer. And also, I think, I mean, not only in homebrew competitions, but just be able to evaluate your own beer.
Absolutely.
And
your
fellow homebrewers in your club or your guild or whatever.
Absolutely. Because despite being a judge, you don't actually enter competitions, do you, Mary?
No.
No. Okay.
No, I think, so there's, I always, have, you know, there's some debate. I took the BJCP classes at the first, actually, group back in 2006 and tested out in June. And then I think I finally accumulated enough experience points last year or the year before to finally make national. And I run into people occasionally who are very anti-BJCP. And even, you know, when talking about the Guild, I mean, like Vlad said, the Guild's run classes since 2006. I mean, every year we have almost a full class every year, or we've had a full class every year, I believe, yep. at least for the last five. But there are some people that are anti, and I think because, for a number of reasons, I mean, the BJCP guidelines are such that there's very set types of beer. We have categories and subcategories of beer like Russian Imperial Stout and Foreign Export Stout and Sweet Stout.
Right. And brewing to style does not necessarily make a good beer.
Correct. And then also, I think a lot of people feel like, well, you know, not all, me I mean, too. We're all trained as judges. Now, we all test out on the same exam. Obviously, there's a range of scores within each category. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I'll admit, I get out a lot and drink a lot of different commercial beers. And I think that it really depends, the judges depend on kind of, you have to keep your palate trained and fresh. And that's one reason why we're doing the show today, is because I think even if you have an amazing palate, you have to kind of continually calibrate it and continually test it and really think about what you're tasting and smelling.
And in the BJCP class, you can actually reach out to the BJCP, whoever's teaching the class. You reach out and they have a Siebel kit. Is that that's what they have, of a bunch of off flavors, and you take a light beer and you doctor these to kind of really pinpoint specific off flavors. And so Mary has devised this kind of do-it-yourself thing, so you don't need to
buy a Siebel kit, which I think the Siebel kits are fantastic, but they are quite expensive. And
if you don't have a lot of people to do it, maybe you have
four friends that you would just want to get together with and kind of go over some of these off flavors, learn what they taste like, and then, you know, do a mini study group where you want to talk about why these off flavors are caused, how to fix them, etc., and be able to identify them both in aroma and flavor. Then I think a homemade kit is great. I actually got this inspiration from another blog. We also have full directions. I wrote up this on my own personal blog, My Life on Craft, full directions on how you can create your own kit. The first beer we're going to do is acetaldehyde. And what is acetaldehyde? Anybody, come on, chime in.
What does it taste like?
Yeah, or smell like, or...
It's the classic green apple aroma you get mostly. I pick it up more, for me personally, it's more in the aroma than the flavor. Mm-hmm. But that's also something I find that these kits are really good for, is I've learned my sensitivity to certain off flavors. For example, diacetyl. I need a lot of diacetyl in a beer to know if it's there. So if I'm judging and a judge is like, oh, this beer has way too much diacetyl and I don't notice it, I now know to say, like, oh, okay, I trust you on that one.
Mm-hmm. Right, agree. And that's
what I'm saying for the acetaldehyde. I get it more in the aroma. Some people get it more in the flavor. It's really, you know, it's up to you. It's good to know your own limitations in that, in terms
of
judging.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another reason why it's good to do a kit like this, or a Siebel kit with a group of people, is that you get a better idea. Again, like, same with me. I'm not super sensitive to diacetyl. We're going to do diacetyl later on in the show. I'm about probably medium sensitivity range, it seems, compared to everybody else. I've know some people that have absolutely don't pick it up at all. And then some people that are extremely sensitive to it. So I think a lot of these things, another thing like the kind of dirt flavor, which I never can remember the chemical name, but that's something that I think part of it is I don't find it offensive. And so I don't really pick it up. That's one thing when we do the Siebel kit, I've helped teach the off flavors class. The last few years, and when we do the Siebel kit, that's when I'm like, yeah, I just know I'm not gonna pick this up. I can't, you know, I'm not a good person to compare with.
So you ask, what is acetaldehyde?
Yes.
So acetaldehyde, if I remember correctly, is one of the many compounds that are produced by brewer's yeast when they do their work. And under a healthy fermentation, the yeast will clean up the acetaldehyde as part of the fermentation process.
Yep. It's actually converted to ethanol alcohol.
Great.
So how do you, I mean, so what did, we just took for this homebrew off flavor kit, or this homemade off flavor kit, we took some green apple concentrate.
Yep. And I went to New York Cake Supply Store, which is great. This is a little, now these are not perfect. This is a little bit candy-like, I find. But I still think it's a pretty good representation of the aroma and flavor of acetaldehyde. So this is actually by Loran Oils. It's just regular apple flavor. You could pick these kind of, if you buy this one particularly, you will need to use 8 drops per 12-ounce bottle or can. And we're actually starting with Coors Light because we found that that's one of the most neutral beers. I feel like it's good to, you could also do this in a craft ale, maybe like a Sam Adams Light or something like that. But I really think if you're training your palate, particularly if you're new at this, or even recalibrating, it's good to do it in a very neutral beer because you really want to hone in on this particular off flavor and aroma. So let's taste. So we added eight drops of this Loran Oils apple flavor to a 12-ounce can of Coors Light. And it definitely...
It's very much in the aroma.
I agree, a Jolly Rancher.
Yes.
But I get nothing in the flavor. I don't know if that's just me. Like I say, I know I'm not sensitive to it too much in the flavor. But
I get a little bit in the flavor, actually, at that very end. But more so in the aroma, for sure. What do you think, Vlad?
The aroma's blunt. But yeah. I get it a bit in the tail end. It comes off as a little bit of an acidic sort of twang.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We also, one thing important, so kind of rewinding, one thing important when you do this kind of, any kind of palate training is to have, you want a calibration beer. So we're sitting in the studio, we actually have our calibration beer, which is just a plain Coors Light, not doctored, and we have a glass of that in front of us each, and then we also have our doctored beer. So, you know, between sips or smells, it's always nice to kind of start by smelling your calibration, your non-doctored beer. So give it a nice sniff again. You know, with the traditional Coors Light, I get a teeny bit of kind of corn aroma.
Ah, yes. It gets
a little bit of sweetness, like, you know, light sweet maltiness. But otherwise, it's a pretty neutral. So definitely, I mean, when you smell the regular Coors Light and then you smell this doctored Coors Light, it's a significant difference. We could probably go down. You could probably go down on this.
I think 8 drops is a bit much, personally, for this. I mean, for my threshold, at least.
Yeah, definitely the aroma is pretty big.
Yeah.
I mean, I find that rolling it off kind of gets it more normal. Like, if you just kind of swirl it around in your glass, it kind of rolls a lot of that off, and then it becomes more of like, okay, that is a kind of where I'm trying to look for it, where it becomes challenging in a competition to detect.
Mm-hmm, I agree. And so acetaldehyde, as we said, it's a natural, it occurs pretty much during every fermentation. It's usually converted or reabsorbed by the yeast, I believe converted mostly, to ethanol alcohol. And what causes this most commonly in home brewing? So A, you're not pitching healthy yeast, either you're under pitching, so too small of a cell count, or maybe the yeast is stressed, or your fermentation stops early, either because it was the temperature went too low, or... Again, it was a health issue. Maybe there weren't enough nutrients in your beer. Or you rack it too soon. You think it's done and you rack it off, or you know, and you keg it or bottle it too soon. Those are all ways that you can get acetaldehyde. I believe you can also get it through an infection, if I'm not mistaken. I actually have a cheat sheet in front of me. Yeah, it says some bacteria can cause green apple. Because I actually had a beer not too long ago that I let sit for a very, very long time, and I think it got an infection, and it really got a lot of acetaldehyde. So, and I think that was why.
So is acetaldehyde ever appropriate?
I don't think it is. No, it is. Oh, Vlad's saying yes. Okay, I'm corrected.
It was a leading question. I'm almost certain that it's acceptable in small quantities in light lagers.
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
And every once in a while, when I'm drinking a light American lager recreationally, and it does happen, I, for some reason, just pick up on it more so than I ever remember picking up on it in the past. Maybe it's like a hot day and I'm drinking way big on the Coors Light. Actually, last time I had it was with a Miller Light.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're right. It says low levels of yeast character, green apples, DMS, or fruitiness are optional but acceptable.
There you go.
Interesting.
But
although in the flavor it says no fruitiness.
Do you find it in your control here? Mm-mm. At all?
I'm not picking it up.
I don't get it in this one, no. I get just more corn coming out of the control than anything.
And I'm not clear on why I pick up on it on occasion and not other times, when we know that these breweries have such intense and rigorous quality control. So I just don't know why it's once in a while that at least I pick up on it.
Right.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break and we'll come back with more off flavors and talking about calibrating
more
your palate.
And competitions.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. Every Wednesday at noon, Dorothy Cann Hamilton, founder and CEO of the International Culinary Center, interviews the top chefs in the world on Chef Story. Hear from chefs like Christina Tosi.
I'm going to be the best pastry cook this restaurant's ever seen.
Francis Malman.
Cooking with fire, it's very feminine, it's very fragile.
And Jacques Pepin.
I was invited to work at the White House for John Kennedy.
Learn how the greats become great every Wednesday at 12 p.m. on Chef Story at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome back to Fun Men About It on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm here in the middle of three national beer judges ranked by the BJCP. I have a little of inferiority complex right now, but it's pretty awesome. Great palates.
We're doing off flavors.
We're doing off flavors. Talking about off flavors and how to get them, how to fix them, and how to really get so you're to train your palate to be able to find them and to do this at home very simply through by going to your local cake store and getting artificial flavors, such as green apple, we just tasted, and to exemplify acetaldehyde. And next up we have
diacetyl. So we, again, this is from the New York Cake Company Cake and Baking Supply, but you can buy these, I know, if you're not in New York City, you can buy these at a lot of craft stores like Michael's Arts and Crafts sells a lot of cake decorating. So this is actually the Wilton Clear Butter flavor, and it just says artificially flavored, but it is really, I mean, it smells like microwave popcorn. So diacetyl is a compound that is also usually a yeast malfunction. So it's, again, a compound that's produced by the yeast and then actually reabsorbed. So there's a couple different reasons that you can get diacetyl. And it's typical. So diacetyl, when you smell it in a beer, it's butter. I always think butter popcorn. You can also butterscotch.
Butterscotch, yeah.
And I don't, again, this is one, like we were talking about, acetaldehyde I get mostly, and you get also on the in the aroma. I get diacetyl more in the aroma. I almost never, it's like a kind of an oily taste,
like a
or
slickness,
sensation.
Slickness on your palate almost.
Yeah.
I get it. I have a very low threshold for diacetyl, and I can taste it in a lot of different things. Taste it and smell it.
I have one of those. And it is something, it is acceptable in certain beers at low levels.
Mm-hmm. Especially English-style beers.
English-style ales, yeah.
And I think one of the, possibly one of the reasons that is because, so again, as we said, it's a compound that's produced by yeast and then reabsorbed. So a lot of times if you have a yeast that is, you know, flocculates out fast or maybe just doesn't go all the way, again, in lagers, if you need to use a diacetyl rest, so you bring it up to a certain temperature for a couple days to allow those yeast to fully do their job and reabsorb this compound. Again, just I think, you know, if yeast aren't healthy and they're not able to make it all the way through. And then there's one other way that you always get diacetyl in a bar.
Not cleaning your lines.
Yes.
Which is a shame because the beer will be in fantastic shape. And it's left the brewery in pristine condition. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just left the brewery a few days before getting to the distributor. And then it goes through those lines that have not been cleaned. Have had God knows how many different styles of beer running through them.
Yep, and so dirty lines, if bars do not properly clean their lines, they can get a buildup of Pediococcus and Lactobacillus, and those two bacteria can produce produce diacetyl anyway. And that's why, you know, sometimes you'll roll into a dive bar and order something on tap that I know should be most commonly like Sierra Nevada or Sam Adams, right? And I taste it, I'm like, this is not what this is meant to be. And it's not, certainly not the brewery's fault. It's really because the bar has not been cleaning their line. So that's typical source of this.
And what's the ratio of Coors Light to clear Wilton butter flavor?
So if you're using Wilton clear butter flavor, we determined. So Chris and I, a couple years ago, Chris and I sat down and I had all these flavorings that I bought. And we went through and we determined exactly, drop by drop, exactly kind of where we thought, how many drops it would require per 12 ounce, and then also we did a 6-pack amount.
I want to apologize to the judges in the room because I've actually been stirring with the dropper, so I think we're actually getting a double dose of everything because of my decision to stir. Don't stir with your dropper.
I think that's the point.
So all these are, at least the acid and all that in this are
pretty
strong.
So now to me, I have like a medium threshold for this. I'm not super sensitive.
Oh man, this is really buttery.
See, I find it's like, oh, you know, this is actually making the beer a little bit nicer.
Exactly.
It's kind of fruity, like ale-like.
I agree.
I'm totally blind to diacetyl, and I can. This is hitting me over the head.
You might have had one of the ones on the left before the dropper got diluted a little bit, but this is hitting me over the head. I mean, diacetyl usually does. It's like, whoa.
I mean, I definitely get in the aroma. Again, I don't really get in the flavor at all. Maybe at the very back.
I find it just accentuates the sweetness of the beer, but I don't get sort of that slick feeling that I sometimes get in when it's really, really present, which is when I know, like, okay, if I'm getting that mouthfeel and a little bit of butter aroma, then there must be tons in there.
Yeah.
It must be offensive to most people.
I was thinking this is very highly carbonated beer, and I wonder if that doesn't kind of scrub that sensation up. Like sometimes when you have beers that aren't as highly carbonated, you can get that greasy sensation more.
So with that, I mean, how much should somebody then, I mean, everybody has a different threshold. How serious should people take their judging sheets when they get them back from competitions?
Diacetyl or in terms of anything that the judge has to say?
Well, anything, but also diacetyl, and you know, you'd just have to, I guess, I mean, I'm answering the question at the same time. I think you have to understand that everybody has a different balance, and all of this is subjective. And, you know, this BJCP kind of gets people to a common page and a common ground, but everybody's still different within it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best thing about BJCP is just, I mean, I do judge competitions. I don't enter. I haven't for a long time, partly because I like to brew these very odd styles that nobody has ever had or knows anything about. And I actually don't care. I don't care to win medals or anything. But I think it's a great way when you're first brewing to get good feedback is to enter your beers into homebrew competitions. And also, it's a ton of fun to judge. And the classes, regardless, even if I never judged, I learned a ton in those classes, not only about brewing, but also, again, it was great to be able to learn this with a whole group of people and to be able to taste these off flavors and other characteristics of beer with a group of people. So I think regardless of what your goal is, attending classes like this is a fantastic tool.
Attending the classes or really utilizing the references that they have actually at bjcp.org. You know, just go in there.
Yeah, the study guide is a wealth of information.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So how seriously should you take your feedback?
Yes, how seriously should you take your feedback?
It depends on how it depends on what you expect to get from the feedback, is my opinion. But I still enter competitions on occasion. I basically just jump to the overall impression comments. That's just me. I want to know what you thought in big picture terms about my beer. I don't really care what you saw and what you... I know what color my beer is. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So the overall impression there is... What's it split up in? A judging sheet?
Aroma, appearance, flavor, mouthfeel, and overall impression. Mm-hmm. And the bulk of the 50 points comes from flavor, but overall impression is interesting because it allows a judge to compensate or to adjust for... For example, you might get a beer that just doesn't fit the style, but you think it's amazing. Mm-hmm. So you have to give it something in the low 20s, perhaps. But, you can give low scores on all of the flavor and appearance characteristics, and then give 9 points on overall impression. Anyway, I find the overall impression to be the most useful.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, you can enter a beer and it'll do really, really well in one competition, and a month later do really poorly in another. So read the comments and understand where the judges are going with it, and then either average them out or enter a third competition. But if you're really interested in getting medals or getting feedback that's useful to you, I think you can't just rely on one or two judges. You need to keep at it.
The other thing is,
I'm always much more honest when I judge in a competition on the judging sheets than I ever am. I mean, we have a homebrew share after at our guild meetings and the other meetings that we go to around the city. And I'll give honest feedback, but never as
bluntly as you will
and honest as I am in a score sheet.
Yeah.
So I think there is a lot of value in getting good feedback. And again, like Vlad said, I mean, that is one thing that people have a hard time with, is that they'll enter a competition and they won't enter it in the style. That's the other tip. So if I could give any tip, if you're entering a competition, don't enter that competition in... So you brew a beer and it's meant to be a double IPA. But lo and behold, you undershoot your gravity and it's not as hoppy and it ends up tasting more like an IPA. Don't be married to whatever you brewed it as. Really taste, sit down with that beer, smell it, taste it, share it with your friends that know the styles, and enter it as the style that it actually tastes and smells like. I think one of the biggest things that people do is that they enter in some, whatever kind of beer. I mean, I know one time years ago, I brewed a porter and it came out more of a brown ale. Not an uncommon thing to happen. I undershot gravity, it wasn't as roasty or it wasn't as, kind of rich as I wanted it. So just that's one thing to consider.
I've had some wonderful beers, like technically proficient, really well balanced, very tasty, and even have asked the steward to go back and double check, like, is this the correct entry number, because this is not, an IPA or a porter or whatever it is. And it's a shame because, you have to give it a very low score. But yeah, I use the overall as a great way to say this is an excellent beer. Just make sure you put it in the right category next time.
Yeah, and sometimes it's difficult to pick those categories. Like if you make a fruit ale that's sour, or, a Belgian beer that has fruit in it, you really have to read through the guidelines to make sure that you're entering in the right category. So Chris is going to doctor one more, but we only have a couple minutes left.
We're talking about some of the more common off flavors today, and we'll get to more next week.
Mm-hmm. As well as, anyway, when I was at the New York Cake and Supply today, I bought some other flavoring, some licorice and some clove and banana, so we can kind of see not just off flavors, but also just flavors. I think really training your palate, there's a lot of ways you can train your palate. I know one time Chris and I drove down to D.C., and we stopped and got some Jelly Bellies along the way. And we decided to do a blind Jelly Belly tasting. Because it is, obviously Jelly Bellies don't represent necessarily true flavors in nature or flavors that you would get in beers. But
if you know
the Jelly Belly flavors and you do a blind tasting, it's a good way to train your palate. That's, your memory is connected. You have memories that are connected with all these, particularly aromas, but also flavors. A sense of smell is an unusual sense in that it doesn't go to kind of this higher learning areas of your brain first. It goes to the forebrain, I believe. And it really, it's more of a gut sensation. So a lot of times, you'll walk by somewhere or you'll taste something, you'll think, oh man, you know, this is a lot of, this reminds me of my grandma's house, or oh, this is
this next taste might remind you of your grandma's house.
I had one time a beer that a friend of mine brewed, and I was trying to remember, and it was circus peanuts. It smelled and tasted like circus peanuts. And I, you know, came out with that. We were actually, I think this was during a class, and I came out with that, and you know, definitely was. I think recently I had a beer that was tasted kind of marshmallow. And those aren't necessarily things you think about, but, you know, they're kind of memory. If you try to bring up memories instead of words. I think that's one thing when you sit down to taste and smell a beer, a lot of times you won't be able to come up with the word, but you can come up with the memory and then the word.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the hardest thing is it's sort of on the, oh, no pun intended, on the tip of your tongue or just like on the outside of your consciousness, and you just can't put your finger on what the heck it is that you're so familiar with.
Oh, this is a weird one. This is representing phenolic.
And what is it? What did we do to Dr. Despair? This is chloroseptic.
Yes, it's sore throat spray. Generic sore throat spray from a drugstore. This is not perfect, but it does give you a medicinal aroma and flavor. It also has a slight numbing. If you do a little too much, you get a slight numbing sensation, which is not, that's not what you'd normally get. But I think it's a good way to teach medicinal aroma and flavor.
Plasticky.
I usually get a slight numbing Band-aid. Feeling after tasting beer.
That's true.
If done correctly, it should always be that way.
And again, the phenols can contribute desirable traits to beer.
That's true.
In certain styles. Others, again, you know, it really depends on the style, and that you have to pay attention to. But in many beers, it's considered an off flavor and one that you want to work very hard to avoid.
Yeah, particularly if it's too much. Like if you get... Like smoke flavor is considered phenolic or clove, and those can be desirable flavors. But if it goes too far, it can be Band-Aid or medicinal.
Yeah, you're going for medicinal with this. You're going for
definitely.
Right, we were talking about this actually before we started the conversation, which is an off flavor is not necessarily always a flaw. It's anything you don't want in your beer.
Right.
So. You know, phenolics can be just about anything, and in some cases, you point out, they're part of, you know, what makes a beer style. For example, German wheat beers, you want that clove, but you certainly don't want it in your APA, your American Pale Ale.
And medicinal is probably, that is a type of phenolic you don't want at all in any style.
Right.
Oh, yes.
So how do you get something medicinal?
Well, a couple different ways. I think it can be a yeast malfunction, again. Also, I believe if you use chlorinated water, you can get that phenolic flavor. What else?
If you don't use your sanitization or your sanitizing methods as they describe, like if your concentration of whatever you're using, bleach, star sand, anything is too much in there, you can get that really plastic.
And also, it can become bacteria. It can produce phenol-like. Flavors and aromas as well. So it could be start of an infection.
Yeah. And wild yeast.
And wild yeast, of course. Great. Well, that is what we have time to today. So we're going to put our link on fermentaboutit.com to my blog that has all the recipes and the amounts that you need to make your own flavor kit. I would urge you to do this.
Absolutely. It's a great, great, great way to train your palate on what to do and what not to do.
Mm-hmm. So we'll return next Monday at 7 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network for part two of our off-flavor flavor.
Thanks to Joe Galarraga and to Jack Inslee, our producer, and to Roberta's in Bushwick.
And Vlad and BR.
To BR and Vladimir Kowalik. Foment about it, over here.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.